We're going to move on now to a series and discussions around movement. Peter Strick, PhD, professor of University of Pittsburgh, distinguished career from NIH and many other places, really an expert in movement and neurophysiological disorders here. His laboratory employs a lot of multidisciplinary techniques, which I think you heard a little bit about from Kit, and I know we're going to have a fascinating series of discussions. So, Peter, I'll turn it over to you.
Again, let me thank the organizers for putting together this event. I'm sure that many of us feel privileged to be present at the creation of something very special. This session is about movement. Virtually every aspect of human behavior involves movement and motor learning in some form. We measure a child's development by monitoring their acquisition of basic motor skills like crawling, walking, speech, and later the use of scissors. Motor skill development in kids is predictive of subsequent cognitive development. In fact, some believe that motor skill development is the scaffolding or foundation upon which cognition is built. Although it's commonly said that you can't teach an old dog new tricks, we can acquire and perfect motor skills at almost any age. Teenagers become experts at video games. Our thumbs can be trained to text at remarkable speed. With a little practice, even aged professional football players like Heinz Ward can become quite skilled at performing the tango. For those of you who are interested, it's still possible to vote for Heinz by going to abc.com. We take our ability to move and to acquire motor skills almost for granted. However, no current computer-controlled robot can reach for objects at arbitrary points in space and lift up objects of different size and shape. This is a task we perform almost automatically. We may marvel at a monkey's ability to use its arm to swing through trees, but think how monkeys must marvel at our ability to use our fingers to type and to play the violin. Even so, the neural substrate for volition, the circuits that make it possible to translate intentions into actions, the brain processes that enable us to acquire and retain motor skills are still all very much a mystery. Our capacity to communicate through speech, reading, writing, and gestures, our skill at using tools, instruments, and devices, and our basic ability to move about and interact with the world all depend on voluntary movement. This is why disorders of movement can be so devastating. This is also why you'll find the speakers in this session so especially interesting. The session will have four presentations. First, we'll hear from an advocate for research on Parkinson's disease. Next, we'll hear about efforts to rewire the brain and spinal cord to promote recovery of function following spinal cord injury or stroke. Then we'll have a presentation about attempts to modify the course of Parkinson's disease. And finally, we'll hear about new efforts to restore function through bioengineering and neural prosthetics. So let's begin. Let's welcome our first speaker, Peter B. Sack, an advocate for research on Parkinson's disease. Peter?
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Sack. I'm a retired public school educator with 11 years of foreign language teaching experience and 25 years as a high school principal here in Massachusetts. I have Parkinson's disease. I was diagnosed 9.5 years ago, and this afternoon I'd like to share with you a portion of my journey. But first, at the risk of being repetitive and redundant, I want to thank the organizers of this conference, particularly Congressman Patrick Kennedy and his co-chair, Garen Steglin, for their advocacy of this critical topic and for their enthusiasm, passion, energy, and commitment, which have brought us all together here today. Patrick and Garen, I've heard you speak often of the importance of service, of making a difference in the lives of others. It is clear to me now that this historic meeting is a living testament to the difference you have made in the lives of a countless number of people. I also wish to thank and acknowledge and honor those of you in this room who are addressing Parkinson's and its complexity. I wanted to share with you today excerpts of a presentation I made nearly 3 years ago about living with Parkinson's disease. Our intention at the time was to inform the Parkinson's community of our existence as a local support group and urge them to join us at our biweekly meetings. It starts like this. About a week and a half ago, on a glorious fall afternoon, I was taking my daily 3 mile walk, wondering what I could do, what I could or would say to a group of people who have come together to learn about Parkinson's disease. After all, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert in neurological diseases. I'm just a guy who happens to live on a daily basis with Parkinson's disease. It occurred to me during my walk that for the last 6 years, since my diagnosis on October 1st, 2002, and actually much earlier when I started noticing certain changes in my body, that living with Parkinson's disease is an uncharted journey. And for me, there have been clearly identifiable stages to this road that I've been traveling. So this afternoon, I offer you Living with Parkinson's Disease, SAC's 20-stage journey. Identification. It was May 2001. I was home working at my desk, organizing the Swampscott High School Scholarship Program, transferring numbers from one page to another. I was having some difficulty with hand-eye coordination. There was an awkwardness in my movements. Rather than a smooth flow, there was a stiffness. Several times in the movies, in particular, without reason or warning, my left leg began to shake. Often I noticed as I was walking at home or outside, my arms were not swinging. I would walk, and my arms would remain by this at my side. I attended a football game on an early September night, temperature 55 degrees. Both legs shook uncontrollably. Something was wrong with me. Realization. I made an appointment with my neurologist. I realized I had a problem. I actually had a pretty good idea what the doctor was going to tell me. Examination. On October 1st, 2002, my doctor's appointment. There are no tests for Parkinson's. No blood tests, no EKGs, no MRIs, no CAT scans. Observation. Just a few simple movements by the doctor. A few questions and voila, the words came out. You have Parkinson's disease. In fact, the doctor told me that when he saw me sitting in the waiting room, he knew even before examining me, he knew I had Parkinson's. I had that characteristic mask. The doctor gave me some prescriptions, some books on PD, and sent me on my way. I was alone and afraid. Information. That night, I lay on my couch and started to read the material the doctor had given me. I got to about page 8 of the first book and could go no further. I would not accept what the future had in store for me. Protestation. I went into a brief period of denial and protest. There was no way this was happening to me. No way. Notification. That weekend, I felt the need to tell a few people of my diagnosis. I called my former wife. We had separated 6 months earlier. She came over to be with me. She even offered to move back in. Not a good idea. I called my sons and made light of the whole thing so as not to alarm them. I called the woman I was dating and gave her an escape clause, an opportunity to gracefully step away from our relationship. She would have none of it. In school on Monday, I met with my two assistants and told them, as well as the superintendent of schools, I didn't know what to expect from PD, but I certainly wanted them to know. Consolation. I spent time feeling sorry for myself and allowing others to feel sorry for me. In retrospect, this was a bad idea. It served no useful purpose, and it dragged me down emotionally. Obfuscation. In the beginning, I spent quite a bit of time hiding my tremors, hiding my walking, hiding myself. Why did I have to have a disease that people can actually see? Medication. I started with only Mirapex. This helped my tremor significantly, but my gait was still a problem. Later, I added Sinemet to my daily regimen, and this helped me with the fluidity of my movements, particularly walking. Communication. I began to become more confident and realized that I could live a relatively normal life with Parkinson's disease. I became more open and willing to discuss my PD with others. And then came a day that I would change my life forever. My school nurse, in whom I had confided, and whose mother had PD, told me of a PD support group in Marblehead, 16 miles north of here. I would have none of that. I wasn't anxious for the world to know I had Parkinson's, nor did I want to see people in more advanced stages of the disease, my future, if you will. Not for me. I didn't want to talk about it, think about it, or share my thoughts with others. This was a private matter. Limitation. I was coping in my own way with PD. I accepted the limitations it would impose on me. I walked, but with some difficulty. I had problems with balance. My handwriting was illegible. My voice was softer. At times, I drooled excessively. I had trouble getting out of my car. I moved more slowly. I had more difficulty swallowing. Determination. In the back of my mind, the idea of attending the support group still loomed. Maybe it would help. I had no one to talk to about PD except my doctor. And so I went, and I met people like Bill and Ruth and Natalie and Lenny and Judy and so many others, some who still attend on a biweekly basis and some who don't. Gratification. Over time, I became a leader in the Parkinson's group, and I'm grateful to the people I met at that time who were incredibly courageous. I share an inseparable bond with them. I also have a more personal support group that includes my former wife, my sons David and Jonathan, and a very patient woman who, after 10 years, we finally married 2 months ago. Imagine my reaction a few years ago when my older son David surprised me with the news that he was training to run in the Boston Marathon to raise money for Parkinson's in my honor. David has so far run in 6 Boston Marathons and 6 New York Marathons as a member of Team Fox, and has raised tens of thousands of dollars, which go directly to Parkinson's research. I'm so proud of him, and to my son Jonathan as well. 2 years ago at the New York Marathon, I had the good fortune to meet and speak with Michael J. Fox. I thanked him for the work he's doing in Parkinson's research, and I thanked him for his inspirational book, Lucky Man, which I highly recommend to you. Motivation. I have been particularly motivated by one sentence in Fox's book. It's the following. It wasn't for me to fret about time and loss, but to appreciate each day, move forward, and have faith that something larger was at work, something with its own sense of timing and balance. Relaxation. And so now I lead a life that is filled with peace and relaxation. I avoid stress because stress exacerbates my symptoms. I have a massage weekly. I attend support group meetings. I take my medication faithfully, and I'm surrounded by good people. Rejuvenation. Remarkably, I feel younger, I'm happier, and I'm a nicer and even more caring person than I've ever been before. Exhilaration. I feel valued, appreciated, and needed. I am more in touch with myself than I've ever been before. Liberation. I am free. Parkinson's has opened my mind to new ideas, new hopes, and new dreams. And finally, number 20, inspiration. At one of my first support group meetings, a woman gave to me a poem, which I have framed and which I read often, and which serves as an inspiration for me. In closing, I would like to read it to you. It's called The Quiet Spirit. Who is this quiet spirit who has come into my world, creeping slowly towards me as its mysterious traits unfurl, discourteously intruding without asking to come in, with no consideration for the person who's here within? It walks in silent footsteps, but steadfast and precise, and slyly interrupts the daily rhythm of my life. It deliberately alters my step, my gait, my hand. and manifests itself in ways that I can't always understand. But the ruinous disease that failed to realize from the start that it may control my movements, but it can't control my heart. And that, my friends, is why I have come to realize that its destructive nature will not be my demise. In fact, I think I'll thank it for the favors it has shown, for it's forced me to consider certain failures of my own. It made me realize in my life that my life was full of useless stress. It's revealed to me the treasures with which I'm truly blessed. It opened up the sky to me and shone a light inside, the window of my soul to view convictions that I hide. My heart feels strangely more content in very special ways, and I savor every moment of every single day. I've discovered things about myself which never came to light. Expressing thoughts for me had been a constant losing fight. So timid and misunderstood, I always felt apart, and now I feel the urgency to open up my heart. Rarely a letter did I write, seldom a note I sent, so difficult it was for me to say exactly what I meant. But suddenly poetry came flowing from my pen, and thus this verse to tell the world how truly blessed I am. So now, 3 years have passed, 3 more years. New challenges have arisen, and the fight goes on. I will not cower in the face of these new symptoms. Quite the contrary, my doctors and I will plan the next approach, and we will continue to ensure a quality of life. And I guess that's where you all come in. I need you to collaborate, communicate, to share your findings, and to be of one mind. Tear down the silos that I've heard so much about for the past day and a half. Tear down the barriers that divide you. Be of one mind for research, and you will make a difference in my life. Thank you very much.
Our third speaker is Dr. Howard Fedoroff. Howard is a professor of neurology and neuroscience, as well as the executive vice president for health science and executive dean for the School of Medicine at Georgetown University. Howard will summarize emerging data that provides insights into when and where Parkinson's disease begins with the hope of modifying the disease's progression. Howard?
Thank you. Let me, like others, thank the organizers. First, this is the time. I appreciate the leadership of Patrick Kennedy and Garen Staglin and the scientific acumen of Steve Hyman. I'm going to begin by talking about Parkinson's disease from a clinical perspective, and hopefully I'll be able to get my first slide. There we go. So this is a syndrome with multiple etiologies. It comes in two flavors, those that are relatively rare, similar to what you heard from David Holtzman today about Alzheimer's, that are monogenic, and the more common sporadic and genetically complex forms. In aggregate, this is the second most common neurodegenerative disease, affecting approximately 1.5 million Americans. Most commonly, this disorder presents at median age, as shown here at 62. It's more common in men, and it has the classic motor findings that are well recognized by neurologists and others. Increasingly more important is that this is not strictly a disease of the motor system, but it involves depression as well as dementia. And I'd like to call attention to several things as I begin talking a little bit more about this. One is the age-related prevalence, but also just to comment a little bit about what is really the signature of this, which is shown here by fluoro PET imaging, which is the diminution of image intensity in the striatum. Now, I'll be talking a little bit more about how one might think about the future of modifying the natural history of this disease by focusing on what we've learned from genetics and genomics, but also I'd like to call attention to one of the histological features of this disorder, which are these proteinaceous inclusions and also chronic inflammation, as I'll talk about in a moment. The growth of this disorder, this is a recent paper published in Neurology, basically showing you that here in the U.S. we will have a growth in Parkinson's, but some other parts of the world, shown here in China, is rather staggering. It's worthwhile talking briefly about the economic burden to our healthcare system. In 2007, roughly $11 billion were expended on the treatment of Parkinson's disease. As I see it, what must be addressed to achieve the goals of treating or modifying the natural history of this disease? First is, how do genetics and genomics guide our understanding? Answers to this, I think, will reveal important information regarding the etiology, pathogenesis, and the ability to stratify risk. Importantly, second, when and where does this disease or syndrome begin? And the implications here would be early diagnosis and earlier intervention. And then when and what elicits neuroinflammation? This will have implications for both pathogenesis as well as for treatment. And what will best inform therapeutics development with respect to modifying the natural history of the disease? I'll submit that this may underlie the understanding of what will be nonlinear pathways or networks, not neural networks, but other biological networks, the identification of targets that might be non-traditional, and also the revision of how this disease is thought about clinically, including its subclassification into different types. So I begin with monogenic disease. In 1997, Mihalis Polymeropoulos, along with Bob Nussbaum at the NIH, described the first family, the Contorsi kindrum, where open reading frame mutation was found within the alpha-synuclein gene. Monogenic PD is shown here as a slide. There are now at least 16 PARP genes showing what their mode of inheritance is, roughly their onset, and then where known, the gene that is the offending gene. It's worthwhile noting that both synuclein comes up twice. One, it was discovered as a triplication by Andrew Singleton, so that it didn't require an open reading frame mutation, but simply the overproduction of the wild-type gene product was sufficient to cause disease in individuals harboring this triplication. And also, I'll make mention of the leucine-rich repeat kinase 2, because this tends to, in some populations, to be the most common form of familial Parkinson's disease. What has genomics taught us? Recently, the International Parkinson's Disease Genomics Consortium published a paper in Lancet, and I've just highlighted again, now this is in idiopathic Parkinson's disease, that both synuclein and leucine-rich repeat kinase again have come up, although now not in a Mendelian fashion in terms of producing monogenic disease, but rather are risk factors for idiopathic or sporadic Parkinson's disease. So the implications of this, I think, are several-fold. One, these monogenic forms, which include synuclein and leucine-rich repeat kinase 2, among others, and the genome-wide association studies, again, have implicated these two genes, among others, in different ethnic populations. And as was shown, although not discussed, GWAS does indicate that the tau locus, MAPT, is also a contributor in certain ethnic populations. So it raises the question, do these two gene products participate in a shared disease network in sporadic disease? So let me now turn to where and where when Parkinson's begin. Many know the work of Heiko Brock, a neuropathologist, who basically had turned the field on its ear, if it were, proposing that perhaps Parkinson's disease, as it were recognized more than a decade ago, was strictly a disease of the central nervous system. And what Dr. Brock has proposed is, in fact, based on a systematic analysis of postmortem tissue from patients who have died, is that Parkinson's disease actually begins outside the central nervous system and progresses to involve it. And in particular, and interesting, I think, for discussion today, is it appears to influence both the gastrointestinal system, the cardiovascular system, as well as the autonomic nervous system. And so one of the features of the Brock staging is shown here in this particular slide, and this really calls reference to the fact that in his classification, the part that we normally associate with the loss of dopamine neurons, which is when the substantia nigra in the midbrain is affected, is really the third stage of this disease. And so in the earlier stages, as he has proposed, there is involvement of the enteric nervous system, the olfactory bulb, and several of the different cranial nerves and their nuclei. And it leads to several different particular features that one might want to give further credence to, such as, I'll just illustrate this one, GI motility and constipation. So the Honolulu Asian Aging Study, HAAS, basically looked at this problem and found that the frequency of bowel movements actually was correlated with the propensity to develop Parkinson's later in life. And so the risk of Parkinson's disease in men with less than one bowel movement per day increased by roughly 4.1-fold compared with men who had more frequent bowel movements. And so Brock has also proposed that perhaps the way that the enteric nervous system is involved is it may be involved in accumulating the same toxic protein that had been described in the central nervous system, and that toxic protein is encoded by the gene product, encoded by the gene synuclein. And so what is being proposed here is that these different enteric nerve plexuses are actually affected in Parkinson's disease earlier in the disease. And in fact, one can stain with alpha-synuclein, as shown here, and demonstrate both at the level of the mucosa as well as the ganglia that there is, in fact, evidence for dystrophic, neuritic constructions as well that are well stained with alpha-synuclein. So in unpublished work, which I found rather interesting and from a colleague, looking at Parkinson's patients to determine whether they might have anything in their bowel that would allow for one to start thinking about what might be a way to detect disease perhaps earlier in the course. And so these individuals whose ages are shown on the left, their unified Parkinson's disease rating scale in here, as well as their Hoehn and Yahr staging, had sigmoidoscopies done. Flexible sigmoidoscopies done of their mucosa of the terminal part of the bowel and stained for alpha-synuclein. And all of these individuals had robust staining for alpha-synuclein compared to a large number of controls, either those that were unaffected with regard to a neurological condition or those who had inflammatory bowel, either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. Interestingly, this is a picture of such mucosa stain in Parkinson's compared to Crohn's and control. So let me now turn to when and what elicits neuroinflammation. Patrick McGeer was probably the first to recognize that activated microglia here associated with a TH-stained dopaminergic neuron were in these microglia were both increasing in number as well as appearing to have undergone the conformational change that is often described as activation. And what's become now known is that inflammation is associated with Parkinson's disease from an earlier stage, and that microglial activation is a correlate of that inflammation and correlates with progression. And when one looks at markers of microglial activation, one can correlate them with alpha-synuclein pathology. So one could ask the question, does synuclein, the purified protein, activate microglia? So shown here is in a tissue culture photomicrograph treated with LPS, which is a potent activator of macrophages and microglia, as well as here shown on the right, treatment with alpha-synuclein. And what you can see is that these microglia are undergoing an activation, quantified here, demonstrating that in a dose-dependent fashion, synuclein produces microglial activation and also elicits the release of a very powerful pro-inflammatory mediator, tumor necrosis factor alpha. This has also been replicated in a mouse that expresses from a catecholaminergic promoter, synuclein, where one can show in the brain of these animals an elevation in the number of activated microglia, as well as both an elevation in TNF, tumor necrosis factor alpha, both in the substantia nigra, as well as in the projection area in the striatum. Most intriguingly, in these mice, this inflammation greatly antedates the ultimate loss of neurons by almost 2 years, suggesting that there might be different epochs, and this might be relevant to study in the context of human Parkinson's disease. So to summarize this little piece, healthy tissue, activated microglia, and ultimately cell death. One of the ways that we think this is happening is the participation of alpha-synuclein to activate microglia and then to produce a pro-inflammatory environment that ultimately compromises the viability of dopaminergic neurons. So what will best inform therapeutics development with respect to modifying natural history of disease? One is a better model. Recently, we published that one can create a model that of leucine-rich repeat kinase 2 to test whether the allele that normally is associated with familial Parkinson's will engender nigrous striatal degeneration. And so the way this was done was to deliver this using a gene expression construct into the striatum. It gets retrogradely transported back to the midbrain, and then to ask, is there dopamine neuron loss, and do you lose the fibers that innervate the striatum, the dopaminergic tyrosine hydroxylase fibers? And so looking at the midbrain, in fact, there is profound loss of dopaminergic neurons compared to the wild type or to an unrelated control expressing just a fluorescent protein. And if one looks at these two anatomical areas, you would predict that both should be affected, and indeed they were. There was a diminution in the amount of tyrosine hydroxylase fibers innervating the striatum in animals that had received this G2-2019S construct, and similarly there was a substantial loss in the number of Th-positive neurons. So this sort of suggests the opportunity to develop a kinase inhibitor, and while this is a kinase inhibitor of modest potency and specificity, it nonetheless was effective in being able to abrogate the G2019S loss of substantia nigra dopamine neurons in this new model of Parkinson's disease, as quantified here in the lower panel. So the other improvement is a technological improvement. There are many biologics that will be delivered systemically, and they cannot be able to reliably penetrate into the brain. And so therefore, direct instrumentation and convection-enhanced delivery will enable parenchymal application. And to do this with great precision, image-guided innovation was required. And this approach will be used in an upcoming and planned gene therapy trial expressing GDNF. But the idea is to be able, in the MR, to be able to precisely position the distal end of a catheter in the anatomical region to which one wants to deliver a biologic. And when one does this in a non-human primate, this is into the putamen unilaterally, you can anatomically produce great precision and follow the imaging in real time to make sure that the biologic was delivered. So in my last slide here, let me just say, delivering on the promise. How do genetics and genomics guide our understanding? They will identify targets and networks, they will illuminate pathogenesis, and they will need to determine whether they have clinical utility. Where does it begin? The premotor phase clearly antedates this motor phase, perhaps by many years, and these features may soon yield premotor diagnoses and the opportunity for earlier intervention. What about inflammation? Well, the early brain phase is associated with microglial activation, and it may well be that synuclein is a major mediator. And with regard to therapeutics development, the predictable models are going to be essential. It would appear that this target, LRRK2 G2019S, is a robust target for drug discovery and development, and that new modalities for drug delivery will herald the acceleration of biological therapeutics for Parkinson's. So if there are going to be moonshot goals, they're going to be slow progression and delayed onset. And thank you for your time and attention.
Our final speaker is my colleague, Dr. Andrew Schwartz. Andy is a professor of neurobiology at the University of Pittsburgh. He will talk about his efforts to use brain signals to control a high-performance prosthetic arm and hand. Andy?
Well, first I want to express my gratitude for the opportunity to tell you all about our most recent results. So I'm combining engineering and neuroscience. And one of the classic ideas of studying the brain is being able to observe what the neurons are doing. And so here's a cartoon which you can think of as a magic instrument that lets you look at all the neurons in the brain at the same time. And so what we have here is a puppet that's making a volitional movement, and we're watching the corresponding brain activity as he does this. And what you'll see is that there's not just isolated parts of the brain that are active, but rather most of the brain is active in a very complex pattern. And one of the things that I would like to do as a systems neurophysiologist is to look at that pattern and try to understand what it means in terms of making movements. And so one of the experiments that we did was to train a monkey to draw, just like you saw that puppet, while we recorded a single neuron in his brain. In this case, the monkey was drawing in virtual reality, and he was moving his arm around and around in this donut. And what I'm going to show you is the monkey making a movement and the corresponding activity of a single neuron in the motor cortex as he does this task. So this is what the monkey saw. This cursor, or this ball, represents his hand, and what he did was put his hand in this object and trace it 5 times, and I'll show you the activity, what it looks like. So there's the monkey moving, and what you hear is a neuron firing. And you'll see that that neuron bursts in certain parts of that movement in a consistent way. So the idea then, if we think about this, is that this directional tuning can be expressed as a cosine function, which in terms of engineering is an engineer's dream, because that means we can apply simple linear equations, the simplest models that we possibly can, to these findings. And that also means that we can express these as vectors, and I'll show you why that's important in a second. And the bonus is that as neuroscientists, we like cosine tuning as well, because it turns out that this cosine tuning is characteristic of neurons throughout the entire nervous system. So everywhere you look, anytime there's some sort of response that's related to the direction of movement, it's expressed with these cosine functions. So this is what I mean by a cosine function. This is work that was done in the early 80s by Apostolos Georgopoulos at Johns Hopkins. And again, this is just another way of plotting this directionality. So if you have direction of movement down here and how fast the neuron fires, that neuron that sounded like a Geiger counter, so you said how fast did it fire, and you look at different movements, and here are the data points. As you go and you compare movement direction to impulse rate, you can fit it with this cosine function. And then again, this cosine function is sort of the magic of what we were able to discover with all these years of basic research. So when I talked about that, that when you see that cosine function, that means you can express your discharge rate as a simple linear model. So this is about as simple as we can get as an engineer. This is the x direction of the movement, the y component of the movement, and then these are just regression constants. So we have to find these b's, and when we find these b's, we can predict movement direction. And these b's, as it turns out, is the preferred direction of the neuron. That's the direction that the neuron likes to fire in. So in that last example, the neuron liked to fire when he was moving up, and that's what those b's represent. So just briefly then, we can represent these b's, or the preferred direction, as a vector. It's pointing, in that case, in that example, it's pointing upwards. And the movement can vary all over. So in that case, the movement was varying 360 degrees as the animal went around that oval. And this is the classic dot product relationship. But basically what that means is that the firing rate is related to the cosine of that angle that I was telling you about. Okay. So just briefly, what that means, again, is that there's a preferred direction. That example I showed you can be represented by a vector or an arrow pointed straight up. As you vary the movement, you look at the projection of a movement vector onto that preferred direction vector, and it looks something like that, and it will decrease as the movement moves away from that preferred direction, something that looks like this. Okay? So that's the essential finding. And what that means then is that you can represent these neurons as little arrows pointed in their preferred direction. And what you can do then is record from many different neurons, and you find that each neuron has a different preferred direction, and that's represented by these many arrows. And then what you do is you say, how fast was the neuron firing at each instant in time? And you adjust the length of the arrow by how fast the neuron's firing. And if you do this instant by instant throughout a movement, and you add all these vectors together, the resultant vector is what we call our population vector, and it turns out that that's an extremely good prediction of the instantaneous velocity of the hand. And so in this example, we had a monkey drawing a spiral, and we looked at his neural activity, and we found that using this method, we could predict precisely what his hand was doing from the neural activity. So there he is. This is real data from a neuron that was, from a monkey that was drawing a spiral. And you can see that I get an extremely good instant by instant representation of what he was drawing. So this is all generated by his brain activity. And it comes by understanding how we can predict the instant by instant movement represented by this yellow population vector. So now we have this tool to look in the brain and predict movement on an instant by instant basis. And what I'm going to show you now is how we can use this for neuroprosthetics. So we have now a way to look in an individual's brain and see the movement that he intends to make, and now we can produce it for him with an external device. Okay. So in order to do that, we need to record from many neurons simultaneously, and in the last 15 to 20 years, the technology has been created that allows us to record from many individual neurons at the same time. In this case, we're using a Utah electrode array, and this is a 4x4 millimeter platform made out of silicon, and it has 100 electrodes with a small recording sites at each of these tips. So this is the experiment that we did. The monkey, again, was implanted with one of these arrays in his motor cortex. We recorded individual neurons, found their preferred directions, took all the neurons we could record from and added those cell vectors together to get a population vector. That was the instantaneous velocity. We fed that into this robotic device and moved an arm according to the monkey's intention. In this case, the monkey was reaching out and grabbing a piece of food in order to feed himself. So the equation we used this time was more elaborate. It had three dimensions because the animal now can move anywhere in the space in front of him, and it could control this gripper, this sort of artificial hand to grasp the food. If you look under the hood, the software and the electronics is somewhat complicated. I just want to talk about two features. One of the features is that in order to get these tuning functions, we had to have the monkey watch us make these movements. So imagine we want to do this with a paralyzed person that couldn't move. We need to know each of that subject's the preferred directions of the neurons we record, but the subject can't move. So what we have the subject do then is watch a movement, and then as the subject, or in this case the monkey's watching the movement, we can watch the way the neurons fire, get the tuning functions, find the preferred directions, and then use those as the monkey tries to control the device himself. The other thing that I want to emphasize is that we use training wheels. So when we capture this activity, we're just generating a crude model of how we think the brain works, and we're just recording maybe 100 or 200 neurons out of billions that are normally active. So this is a rather small sample, and it's noisy, so we help the animal in the beginning by guiding the movement for him a little bit, and as the animal gets better, we take the training wheels off and let him fully operate the device. So these are the key features to the success we've had. Okay, so I have time for a quick joke here. We had a lot of publicity for this, and University of Pittsburgh, we have a large neuroscience community with a lot of interdisciplinary interaction, and one of the people that works there is a math professor named Brent Dorian, and he went to go get his hair cut, and he was sitting in the chair, and the hairdresser says, "Well, what do you do?" And normally if he says, "Well, I'm a math professor at Pitt," that's sort of the end of the conversation, rather instantly. So he kind of scratched his head and said, "Well, did you see that guy at the University of Pittsburgh who hooked a monkey up to a robot arm?" And she said, "No." And she said, "Well, what good would that be?" And he said, "Well, imagine that someone's paralyzed and can't feed himself. He could use this device to feed himself." And she thought for a moment and she said, "Well, how would the monkey know what the guy's thinking?" All right. So one of the things that we wanted to do is, you notice on that last device, there was no wrist. And that made the task difficult for the monkey to do because he had to be very precise in the way he reached for the marshmallow. So what we've done recently now is add more terms to our equation. So we add wrist movement, which has three more dimensions of movement. So now we're up to controlling seven dimensions of movement. And what we did first was have the monkey reach with his own hand for these devices so that we could study the way the neural activity worked in his brain. And so he'd reach for these devices. There'd be a robot that presented this to him, and he'd reach, and we'd monitor his hand movement and then look at the neural activity. And when we did that and looked at the three wrist angles and fit that into our model, we could see that this dotted line fit the solid line very well, meaning that our model was almost perfect in predicting these wrist movements. So that suggested then that when we went to try to use this in a prosthetic device, that our equation was valid. And here you see now the animal using this device, and it now has a wrist on it, and he's reaching for these cylinders that are presented in different orientations in front of him. So now we wanted to expand it to hand movement, and so we had him do the same experiment with moving his hand, reaching to a variety of objects, and we presented that to him, and we divided hand movement into four principal components, or four basic hand shapes, fit that into our equation, so now we're regressing against 10 dimensions, and we can predict that. Here's our prediction from the monkey moving his own arm and us being able to predict it. You can see how well we do. And so now we need a device that allows us to have a hand, and we're using this new device courtesy of Jeff Ling at DARPA that has 17 degrees of freedom, and you can see how well it moves. And then we just got this a couple weeks ago. So I think you can see the potential of this. And this summer, we're going to be implanting our first patients at the University of Pittsburgh with two of these arrays, and then having them use this arm to do acts of daily living. Thank you.
We have time for several questions.
Hate to be the skunk at the party here, but in case you wanted to look at yesterday's symposium on brain-gate interface, part of our program yesterday by Lee Hochberg, you may notice the videos were similar. Yesterday we saw it already, this demonstration. And it's ironic because I appreciate the great work that you do, that you talked about University of Pittsburgh, which does a lot of this cutting-edge research. But BrainGate was also something that was instigated at Brown University under the leadership of John Donahue. And when John couldn't be here, and you were here, good enough to take his place, he's over and trying to convince the Nobel Committee to do more awards in this field. He said, "You know, I'm really sorry I can't be there because you just put my competitor up there." But, you know, it's not a laughing matter for all of us who don't have enough money to get to the solution. And instead of recognizing each other's work, each of them is fighting for the recognition themselves. Now, I think both of you need to be at the task of doing what you're doing. But we need to figure out a process where we can ultimately either do it together or have a competition where the money goes to where it's most effective. And for in politics, that's a dangerous game. Because it means that the money might not come back to my district. So when we're talking about how do we create a new paradigm to do this research, and I say we need political science to apply to neuroscience, you think neuroscience is difficult. Try convincing a colleague that by going the best approach in order to save Kit Parker's colleagues in battle who can't afford duplication of effort when dollars and time on task is the difference. So I only, you're unfortunately the recipient of making this illustration, and I respect the work you do, but it illustrates what everybody here is convening to try to overcome, and that is how do we get more organizational structures that incentivize people to join in a common effort. When the common goal is more expedient cures to people who need them and who can't afford to wait because we're duplicating resources, when those resources, if better appropriated, could go to achieving more scientific advancement as opposed to a duplication in effort. And I want to ask the panel here, now that I've totally made myself the skunk at the party here, is if we were to have a moonshot, and everybody remembers Neil Armstrong saying, that small step for man represents a giant leap for mankind. Before the decade is out, could you repair the spinal cord and allow paralyzed veterans confined to their wheelchairs to ultimately be able to take the first step out of that wheelchair because neuroscience reconnected the spinal cord? Any one of you?
You may be, Reggie Edgerton's in the audience here, I think. There was recently a paper that involved a combination of epidural stimulation training where somebody who had no leg function with a combination of these modalities actually was able to stand and to make steps in a controlled way. Is that going to be applicable to all patients with spinal cord injury, all veterans? I think there's very high probability that multiple approaches will work together to make a real difference. I don't have any kind of crystal ball about when exactly is that going to happen. I'm going to have to defer on that. I think there's a lot of people working very hard to bring multiple arms of research together, and there's huge amount of progress that's happening. And I would be very reticent to say that there's duplication or wasted effort going on. I think the multiple strands of research that are going on are all highly synergistic and highly helpful to each other. And it, most likely in tackling a problem like spinal cord injury, it will require multiple approaches to work together. And I think that's happening already.
So I'd like to address a comment as well. And I think Senator Kennedy brought up an interesting point, and that's looking at the way science works. 25 years ago when we came out and we first introduced the idea of tuning to movement direction in motor cortex, John Donahue was completely opposed to this idea. This was against the basic scientific trend at the time. And as he started, and it took a few years for this to catch on, and once it did, then John was able to use it in his research as well. And without this competition among scientists to see which scientific theories hold the most water, we wouldn't advance at all. And now, as we progress, I think you'd see that the work we do in my laboratory is pushing the envelope in terms of the skill and the kind of movements that can be produced with these robots. And John has put an emphasis, perhaps, on getting this into humans, while we've emphasized doing the basic research in monkeys. And I think it shows that you need both things and a wide spectrum of approaches.
So if I could just, the paper that was recently published on the spinal cord injured patient, he may not have had a full cord transection, but very close to it, and it was electrical stimulation combined with a very rigorous rehabilitation program. One patient, but very promising. I would also agree that multiple approaches to spinal cord injury, recovery from spinal cord injury, will be very important. And so I don't think we're ready yet to choose A or B. And if you choose now and you make the wrong choice, there can be devastating consequences. I would also say that NIMES has supported a number of prosthetic programs. A number of them were done by contract, and a couple of years ago we actually had a competition to see which of the several contractors we were working with would be most effective. And there was actually a winner, and he and so we can make those difficult choices.
I had a comment, let me actually add on to Patrick Kennedy's. I think what he's saying too, if two people are working on the same thing, obviously he's saying abandon one approach or abandon another, but if those two people are working on the same thing, they should collaborate. Now, I know firsthand, nothing's more important to the cure to a spinal cord injuries to a person that has a spinal cord injury. And that's no knock on the research, because I mean, I don't want you to go out there and get run by a car. But in Ohio, in the 80s, there was two famous doctors, Dr. Petrovsky on 60 Minutes and Dr. Marcellet. They were both being funded by the VA. Dr. Petrovsky did neuromuscular stimulation, and Marcellet did it up in Cleveland. They hated each other. The first time they ever met was in Paris. And maybe one suggestion would be if you get federal funding, it should be a law that you have to share your information with your competitors. That's one way to maybe keep those dollars the same. But I knew them both personally. They hated each other. But one point I want to make too is if you Google, and this is, I think, the beautiful thing that Patrick's doing, with strength in numbers and bring the spinal cord injury in this one mind for research. If you Google, you mentioned up there the causes of spinal cord injury, car accidents. I happened to work at a ranch in Los Amigos when I first accounts with this young guy from Ohio who goes out to the ranch and meets all these gang members and all gunshots. But the link of schizophrenia to spinal cord injuries, if you Google that, there's not one study, and people are probably thinking, well, where's the connection? And here is the connection. I grew up in Ohio, and I have my master's degree in counseling, so I'm a self-diagnosed myself with ADD, so just stay with the story. There is a grew up in Ohio, and I hate to use the word normal, but back in the 70s, we used it. Lived in the suburb. Everybody's dad worked at the rubber factory. She played sports. If you're a Catholic, you went to church to get that missalette, so you go to the party that night. But sports was everything. And for me personally, I had a mother. My dad worked 1 hour earlier than all the other neighbors. So I would get up 1 hour early, knock on the doors, and the neighbor mom would come over. Level 49, I hate to use this word, Stevie. Love little Stevie, can you come a little bit later? So me and my mom would play catch, and she was blind in one eye. And so if I didn't throw it exactly at the left side, it would hit her. So a kid does not want to hit her mom, so eventually I became the top pitcher in Northwest Ohio. But on one morning, December 28th, 1978, it changed my life. It was in Ohio, 15 degrees, and I had to walk 2 miles to basketball practice. And my mom asked me how I felt that morning. I got teenage whiner, got to walk to basketball practice. I sat at a table, I was eating ball cereal, and it just felt different. I couldn't figure out what it was. And kept eating, and all of a sudden, I finally called my mom across the house and said, "Mom, I feel different when you come in here." And I reached down and felt my, my hand, I had a handful of blood in me. I go, "What happened?" And the mom walked in, she had a gun in her hand. She goes, "Steve, I shot your sister, I shot you, I'm going to shoot myself, and we're all going to be in heaven together." And I go, "Mom, we didn't have 911 back then. I need a mom more than ever now. You sit down, call the operator over and over." And I had about prank phone calls, we had about 20 ambulances, but they came. Once I knew she was safe, like, that's when I got scared. And I talked to a paramedic, and in the movies, you see these gunshots, and then all of a sudden, you know, when's the last breath? Well, went down to the hospital, you know, all the surgeries. Luckily, nothing hit the organs, but unluckily, it hit the spinal cord. So for the rest of my life is going to be in a wheelchair. And the reason what happened was, my mother, I didn't know this, had been going to counseling. And the insurance company decided to take the medicine she was taking off the formulary and change to another type of medicine or whatever. and by without triphating the medicine, which means, you know, reducing the medication, and that combination, she went into a psychotic state and resolved that. So by the insurance company treating, you know, my mom, schizophrenia, wrong medication, I became spinal cord injury. And I think the practical thing in this would be for legislation, for CBO scoring, and would help, you know, Congressional Budget Office, everybody talks about the price of the victims. And then just in general, see how many spinal cord injuries are victims of, you know, some type of disorder. And that one decision about changing your medicine changed my life forever. So this is where I can see where the one mind combines everything. And it affects you the rest of your life. So that's where I say, here's the first subject where schizophrenia does connect to spinal cord injury.
When we did our mental health parity hearings around the country, Steve Winter, on his own dime, came to over half a dozen parity hearings around the country so that people could understand what denial of treatment for mental health meant to him. And in telling that very courageous story that he just told, he helped change a country and pass mental health parity. And Steve, you're a hero of mine.
Mr. Sack, thank you for your comments. We appreciate those very much, and thank to all of you on the panel. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and we'll be back with comments from Representative Gephardt and Patrick to wrap things up. So 15 minutes. Please be back in the room at 3:30. Thank you.